We have a double introduction today. My name is Ted Gerber. I'm the director of CRECA. And before I introduce Tomas Longinovich, who will introduce today's speaker, I just want to welcome everybody to our first lecture of the year. And this is part of our regular CRECA lecture series. We have lectures every Thursday at 4 p.m. Those of you who aren't familiar with CRECA, the schedule for the fall semester is available. And this is in the back of the room for those who are interested in other possible lectures of the semester. And next week, for example, we're co-sponsoring a speaker. We won't be in this room, which is our usual room. Most of the lectures do take place here. Next week, we'll be in 22 Ingram, and we'll have David Bachman, who's talking on China, Russia, and North Korea. Interesting set of countries there. Defense, industrial systems, and pathways from socialism. So I'm really glad to see such a nice turnout on such a beautiful spring day, and I'm sure we'll be well rewarded. And I hope everybody's semester is getting off to a good start. So without further ado, I'll turn the floor to Tomas,
sure,
who will introduce today's speaker.
All right. Well, thank you all for coming. And I'm glad that, you know, the first lecture in the CRECA series is going to be on the area of Southeastern Europe, which is, you know, my area of interest and expertise and origin. And it's a great pleasure to introduce Azar Kormajic, you know, who is a lecturer in anthropology at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh and a recent PhD from, you know, University of Pennsylvania, with a dissertation entitled Empty Nation, Youth Education and Democratization in Post-Conflict Bosnia and Herzegovina. And I think that her presentation today is largely going to be drawn on that. She is a specialist in the subsection of anthropology that deals with education, conflict resolution, with international governance and the nation state, ethnic violence and reconciliation, citizenship and democratization, diaspora and immigration, women, war and peace, socialism and post-socialism, and Southeastern Europe in general, but especially focusing on Bosnia and Herzegovina. She has about 5 published articles already, although she's a very recent PhD, you know, 3 of those in refereed journals, some of them in education policy, you know, which is a very prestigious one. And so it is a great pleasure actually to introduce her. She was a student of mine at the University, Central European University in Budapest 7 years ago in a seminar entitled Violence and Culture. And, you know, she was obviously one of the most brilliant students there. So, you know,
no.
I'm looking really forward to her presentation today. So please welcome Azra Kormajic.
Thank you. Here to talk now after you said all these wonderful things. I have to say, it's such a pleasure to come to the place where they introduce you by saying your name properly. It didn't happen to me ever, I think. This is the first time that somebody really did it. So I'm kind of, I don't know, this is too good to be true. Okay. So my talk today is entitled No Man's Land, Youth Negotiating Democratization in Post-Conflict Bosnia and Herzegovina. I have quite a few nice slides to show, so I hope you'll enjoy those. And I have to say, I try to speak slowly, but I have a tendency to speak really fast. And please do interrupt me and say, hey, slow down. Where I come from is someone knows that's polite. So go ahead and interrupt me, okay? I'll start by reading a short vignette. This is a typical, are there any anthropology students or anthropology faculty here? So you know, that's a typical way that anthropological talks usually start. So I'm going to read a short vignette which will capture some of the larger issues I will try to address in this talk. It's entitled Bathroom Ethnography. When I went to the field, I never expected I would end up doing a lot of fieldwork in a bathroom, but I realized in the middle of my fieldwork, when my professor said, be open-minded and go wherever things take you, that's what I meant. Just go, and so I ended up doing a lot of work in the bathroom, but I hope it becomes clear soon. So here it comes. On a beautiful day in the spring 2006, Amna comes up to me, hiding one of her fists behind her back. Let's go and mix, she says. She opens her fist, and I see a cigarette, its long, elegant body rolling up and down her little palm. Let's see if this works. You should move now. Oh, here, it's a little slow. She grabs my hand and leads me to the bathroom located at the end of the crowded hallway away from the teacher's view. We open the door and find ourselves enveloped in the smoke, which is so overwhelming that it blocks the smell of urine. Thanks. I hope this is low. Doing something funny. It's freezing up. Sorry about that. It's frozen. We should have used my...
Many pictures, huh?
76. Sorry about this. We should have... Huh? Let's just make sure. Okay, this is the smell of urine and the smoke that's blocking it. I barely distinguish the sinks attached to the wall. They're covered with cigarette butts, which lay sadly on the wet surfaces. Water from the pipes gently drips on the butts, causing them to swell up. I feel Amna's hand pulling my elbow. I follow Amna's lead, trying not to touch the cold, damp walls. We enter the second, less populated room, which has a window. Finally, I can breathe again. Living in the United States for the last 9 years made my lungs weak. Unable to tolerate the cigarette smoke, the main signature of the Bosnian public spaces. Amna stops next to Igor, hugs him and says, I like to park next to these Croats. I visit them more than they visit me. As Igor lights up Amna's cigarette, three more students smoking join us. One of them says, Amna, would you ever marry a Croat? She replies swiftly, her voice rising above the smoke. Sure, but he would need to convert to Islam first. Damian, whose large silver cross is showing through his yellow shirt, says, no problem, teach me some verses from the Quran. Amna starts without hesitation. Azubillahi minashaitanirajim, bismillahi rahmani rahim. Damian repeats clumsily while laughing. Azubillahi what rahim? We all laugh. I jump in. Marian said yesterday that he would marry a Muslim girl. Marian replies promptly, sure, but only if she's infertile. The whole group laughs. Amna and Marian hug tenderly. The bell rings, signaling the end of recess. The bathroom quickly empties of students who passionately gasp the last bits of smoke before they toss the butts in the sinks. I lean against the window, gasping for fresh air rolling down from the surrounding hills. I feel some curious sadness. I catch myself patting the camera resting in my hands while thinking, is this stinky bathroom the only place in which mixing in Mostar happens these days? So that's the vignette. Okay. So I said I spend a lot of time being in this bathroom and inhaling illegally produced smoke. And what I will try to talk about in this 60 minutes or so is to look at how these practices of smoking and flirting speak to the processes of international democratization of Bosnia and Herzegovina and the history of mixing as a long-standing social order. So I know this is a stretch, but I'll try to do that. And how these practices of smoking in the bathroom address the nature of ethnic interaction among youth in contemporary Bosnia and Herzegovina. And finally, this is the third question is the one that I'm only starting to investigate now. So this is a little bit premature, but I'll still try to address a little bit of this as well. What do these practices of smoking in the bathroom reveal about the possibility of post-identity politics among youth in Bosnia and Herzegovina? What motivates and organizes these emerging post-identity connections? So these are some questions to keep in mind, and I will return to them indirectly throughout the talk. Before I continue exploring, I want to emphasize what I mean by democratization in post-Cold War context. First of all, I mean by democratization in the context of Bosnia and Herzegovina, the international community's active engagement and long-term commitment to post-conflict state-making and nation-building around the world. So Bosnia is only one instance of this engagement that especially became prominent in the post-Cold War era. It's an umbrella term. In the Bosnian context, it does capture, tries to embrace many different policies and processes. But its crucial aspect is reconciliation among ethnically divided peoples. The goal of democratization in Bosnia and Herzegovina is to rebuild the country and reconcile its citizens so they can become modern, democratic, and capitalist with regard for human rights and the rule of law. And as I said, Bosnia and Herzegovina is the first and unique instance of this kind of externally directed state-making in the post-Cold War era. It has been followed by East Timor, Kosovo, Afghanistan, Iraq, and it's to be seen. Okay, so that's what I mean by democratization in the title and throughout. Because it is the term that we like to throw around a lot, but oftentimes we forget that it is this larger term that embraces, in different contexts, many different processes. Okay, so in Bosnia and Herzegovina itself, and I did my fieldwork in Mostar, I'll come to that in a second, I have to say Herzegovina every time I come Bosnia. If you want to be correct, you have to say both Bosnia and Herzegovina. In Bosnia itself, democratization is, I believe, it embraces two main paradoxes. First of all, it's undemocratic because it's mostly imposed by the international community. So I will not go into the detail of this, but basically the international community governs local populations without being accountable to them, and there are great works that anthropologists and others did on how this really works. And second, let's step back. So democratization in Bosnia operates under the idea that citizens and states can be socially engineered by correct practices of external regulation. So it's not that they're built by them participating in democracy, but you have to actually engineer them so they can become democratic eventually. So it's undemocratic in its essence. And then in Bosnia, in its democratization policy, there is a tension between the notion of a nation and the state itself. The nation is imagined as a multicultural nation. There's an idea of a Bosnia as being this place where mosques and synagogues and churches all coexisting peacefully for centuries. And then you have the state, which was basically built in order to keep the parties apart, right? Based on the idea of power sharing and constitutional democracy. So you have this tension between constant state making and state breaking in Bosnia and Herzegovina. So democratization itself is kind of paradoxical. It's both trying to build a state based on this notion of almost romantic Bosnianhood and a very fragmented, ethnically defined state. Okay. So the goal in my larger project, and this partially, is to examine this particular type of political rationality that inserts ethnicity as its people-constituting logic. Basically, I'm looking at how ethnicity becomes the main and basically the only domain through which politics in Bosnia is governed and organized. So there's almost no other way to do politics today. To show how this democratization structures the social and political field in Bosnia and Herzegovina, that ethnicity becomes its main target. I already said that. To reveal democratization's inconsistencies and paradoxes, and to look at their unintended effects on the local context. So really, what happens when you take this very paradoxical structure and try to place it into a local context? And to outline the nature of the political and social terrain that's available for Bosnian people to produce the response. So if you have this kind of democratization that's based on rigidly understood ethnic coexistence, what's left for people? How are people left to respond? How do they organize? What motivates these kinds of responses? In order to achieve this, in April of 2005, I moved to Mostar, Bosnia and Herzegovina. For those of you who are not really familiar, here it is. Bosnia, we always like to say in the center, in the heart of Europe, I don't know, you can decide. It is heart-shaped, kind of, if you want to see it that way. So this is where it is. And
Belgium claims that also.
I know, we all claim it. Wherever you go, everyone says we are the center. Okay, so this is the map of Bosnia. I'm from Bihać, town in the north. And I did my fieldwork in Mostar. In Bosnian terms, I went as far from home as possible, right? But it's like six hours away.
Herzegovina.
Right, Herzegovina, that's a totally different thing, right? Bosnia being geographic description of the northern part, and Herzegovina basically the southern region. So I went to Mostar, just a little bit about Yugoslavia. For those of you who know, this is going to be very superficial, but for those of you who are not that familiar, this might be helpful. Yugoslavia existed between 45 and 91. President of Yugoslavia was Josip Broz Tito. I'm talking about ex-Yugoslavia, I'm not talking about then Serbia and Montenegro. It was a federation of six republics, Slovenia, Croatia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Serbia with two autonomous regions, Kosovo and Vojvodina, Montenegro and Macedonia. It was based on a very interesting notion of brotherhood and unity that was one of Tito's main ideological apparatuses, which posed that all ethnic Yugoslav ethnic groups should peacefully coexist and nurture the notion of intermarriage and cross-ethnic affiliation. And this notion of brotherhood and unity will be interesting and related to what I will be talking about that I term mixing. Many of you are familiar with the fact that Yugoslavia violently collapsed in the beginning of 1990s. So this is just a little snippet on Yugoslav history. Bosnian War, within these larger wars, lasted between 92 and 95. People like to explain this war as a conflict between Bosnian Serbs, Bosnian Croats, and Bosniaks or Bosnian Muslims. Obviously, it's much more complicated, but yes, these are the three groups that are most often explained as enemies in this conflict. The war claimed about 200,000 lives, and 2 out of 4 million people were uprooted, most of them internally, but many of them also externally. And good thing about that is that if you're a Bosnian and you go and travel around the globe, you can find a refugee to stay with wherever you go. That's a positive side of this. A negative side we are all familiar with. So we are everywhere. Dayton Peace Agreement was signed in Paris on December 14th, 1995, and it brought peace to the Bosnian situation. And it installed something called consociational democracy. Those of you who are political science scientists or political science majors know that about this probably much more than I do. Basically, a consociational model of democracy is the model of democracy that envisions the state as composed of groups that share power equally. And in Bosnian case, it is these three ethnic groups that are envisioned as a power sharing with equal number of votes, equal number of representation. And in some places, this worked really well. And I will claim that in Bosnian, using my bathroom, that in Bosnian case, this doesn't work. Okay, so that's going to be part of my... But there is a tension between this model of democracy and the situation, historical, cultural, social, on the ground. And this is what consociational democracy created in Bosnia and Herzegovina. It divided this very mixed, very intermixed region into two very segregated political units. What consociational democracy also does, it really delegates the decision-making from the level of the state, which kind of reminds empty, and that's where empty nation partially comes from, and it delegates responsibility and governance to the level of sub-state. And in this case, that's Republika Srpska to the north, which has 49% of the territory, that's the gray area, and the Federation of Bosnia and Herzegovina, which has 51% of the territory, and which itself is divided into 10 cantons. So you took a very intermixed region and you created a model of democracy in service of peacemaking, where you have Serbs living in a centralized state to the north and Muslims and Croats sharing very segmented sub-state to the south. So only three of these cantons within the federation are intermixed. The others are predominantly either Croat or Muslim. I know this is, for some of you who don't know much about it, this might be overwhelming, but I hope something stays. Okay, so what I'm arguing partially is that the solution to the Bosnian crisis was institutionalization of forced unmixing of a mixed nation. So basically what you had before were people who were intermingling and living together, and then you, after the war, imposed a model of democracy that unmixed them, basically, without trying to productively bring them together. This is what a political scientist, Campbell, calls enclave multi-ethnicity, which I think really captures this. So you still argue that you have a multi-ethnic state, but the way you have it is everyone has its own, it's almost like having a big house, but everyone has its own room and there is no living room, right? So everyone stays in their rooms. So this is what, so that's multi-ethnic. We all live in one house, right? But we never talk. We all also have our own bathrooms usually, which is really... Okay, so the international community came to Bosnia with an assumption about one-dimensional and rigid nature of plurality that could not represent history of contingency and flux of identity in Bosnia and Herzegovina. where people really did intermingle throughout centuries. Not in a romantic way that people often like to portray, but in ways that were full of tension and problems and conflict, but they did coexist. But this model of democracy doesn't recognize that. It puts them in their own houses, okay? So why did I pick Mostar? Mostar has 100,000 inhabitants. It's the largest city in Herzegovina, in southern Bosnia. It was described by the international community as the microcosm of the Bosnian state. It has overwhelming international presence due to this belief. They believe if Mostar, this biggest city in Herzegovina, doesn't succeed as a model of democracy, Bosnia will die. Okay, so there was a very strong emphasis on go to Mostar and save it, and then Bosnia will survive. And it has a history of really serious bloodshed. In 1992, it became a site of eruption of a huge conflict between first Serbs on one side and Croats and Muslims on the other. Then Serb army pulled out, and then Croats and Muslims basically divided up the town and started a really extremely violent conflict. This conflict, what it produced is a totally divided city, Jerusalem. I mean, think about places that are totally divided. So from a very intermixed city that used to, during Tito's time, that was a symbol of multiculturalism and brotherhood and unity, it became absolutely divided city. And what I mean by that is it has two of everything. They're trying to fight against it. It has two bus stations, two post offices, two soccer teams, it used to have two currencies, not anymore. But they, on the cross side, you still can use the currency of Republic of Croatia. You have pretty much two universities, so they're mirror images. In anthropological terms, they're moieties, right? And it's often described as Tamovamo Grad, as one of my informants said, which means a town here and there, right? It's here and there, because it's so divided, okay? And it's also famous because it's the place of a famous old bridge, which is a UNESCO-protected site. This bridge was truly the symbol of Bosnian multiculturalism. If you lived during socialism in the region, usually you were taken on excursion to this bridge to see it, because this bridge reproduced the idea of Bosnia that, regardless of all occupations, resists and survives, because the bridge was witnessed many occupations of the region, moments of conquer of the region, many wars, many struggles. It always survived. It stood until 1993. Okay, so this was the symbol of multiculturalism, coexistence, endurance, the spirit of Bosnia. Bosnianhood was, this was, I cannot think of a bigger symbol than this. So that's why Mostar was a good place to go. However, the bridge was betrayed in 1993, in November of 1993. The bridge was hit by the Croatian army, and it fell into the river. And there is this story about the river itself, the Neretva River, turning pink. And there were people talking about the bridge bleeding to death, okay? But then they discovered later, when they were reconstructing the bridge, that some stone from around there that produced some of this pinkish element was released when it fell in the water, some local stone. But people, you know, use this chemical reaction to talk about bridges dying and bleeding to death. And I remember clearly when I lived 6 hours away under siege in a different town, but I do remember hopes sinking when this bridge died. I have to use that term, because everyone was saying, well, now we're done. Okay, the bridge is dead. If something, because people expected people to die. They didn't expect the bridge that survived everything to die. Okay? So, of course, this is what the bridge looked like immediately after the destruction. So it made sense to go back. The bridge was rebuilt in July 2004. Millions of dollars went into this. The international community framed the rebuilding of this bridge as the most important symbol of peace building in Bosnia and Herzegovina. There were millions of dollars, many on the night of the opening, I was there, many international heads of the state came and witnessed this moment. I mean, it was magical. But many Mostarians did not experience the rebuilding of the bridge in that way. When I moved from the east side, which is populated by Muslims, they celebrated on the night of the opening. I went across to the Croat side, and quite a few of youth were sitting there trying to ignore what was happening. And I asked them, do you care what's going on? And they said, well, no, we never saw it. We don't care. You know, we never go there. You know, that's a Muslim bridge. So after the war, this bridge was reframed as not everyone. I mean, you have quite a few people who still went over it and wanted to see it. But people, first of all, felt disconnected due to post-war politics from the bridge. And secondly, felt that it was the international community's show. It was something they wanted to build for themselves, right? So they can say, look what we did. We reconstructed multiculturalism. So people felt, no, that's their bridge. And even the father of the family I was staying with who had a pass to go to the ceremony, the opening ceremony, said to me, do you want to go? I don't want to go. Real Mostarian people won't be there. That's for them. Okay, so people didn't experience it in that way. And that shocked me. I said, well, if the bridge is not that, what is it? Is there anything else that captures some interest in multiculturalism and reconciliation in the region? And that's how I stumbled upon my school, the Mostar Gymnasium. The schools have a very special place in the context of peace building in the eyes of the international community. They realize if they rebuild the schools, that there will be a higher refugee return. Because many families said, well, I'm not returning to my village if my child cannot study in Bosnian language or Croat language or Serb language. So schools became very crucial. And there was even an attempt to, when they couldn't reconcile which curricula the schools that would be reunified would follow, they even designed something that's a very new phenomenon in Bosnia and Herzegovina. It's called two schools under one roof, where students share the same school building, but they attend two different national curricula. So they go to separate classrooms. Okay, so schools are very important. The Mostar Gymnasium, this school, which looks really pretty, if you ask me, was very. It had a very important place in the history of Bosnia and Herzegovina. We studied about very famous artists and freedom fighters who went to these schools, and also in post-war social reconstruction, it had a special role because it was the first of these two schools under one roof to be reunified. Okay, so they said, well, this is our chance. Let's take this school and show that kids can actually go to one school. Okay, then I can answer questions about this whole educational mess, but I don't want to go into detail right now. So it was conceived, this school in Mostar was conceived as the site of the first integration of two largely ethnically segregated secondary schools, one Muslim, one Croat. So first time after the war, in one divided town, you bring students of two ethnic groups together and try to school them together. Because of its symbolism, there were so many international community people who were at the school when I was there that teachers often complained that it felt like a zoo. Every day the journalists would come and want to interview them and would sit, especially English language teachers, they always were asked. So you would go to school one day and this is what I would see, the days of Egypt and their cameras. And I mean, it was not your typical school because the international community realized, if we can do this, the world will talk, they believed, about this. Okay, so very special school. This is what it looked like when I arrived. It was what's called in the educational jargon administratively reunited in February 2004. People wanted to unite it fully, meaning they wanted Muslim and Croat students together in one classroom. That was the idea. However, there was so much resistance on the local political level that they created something, a new elephant basically, which is we will unite the school on the level of management. It will have one principal and one secretary and one financial person, but it's still going to have two national curricula. Croats will study in Croat language and Muslims, Bosniaks, will study in Bosniak language, which, as most of you know, is the same language. So, we can talk about this. So, still kept two national curricula. So this really captures the nature of reconciliation in Bosnia. Build one house, but put them in two rooms, right? Don't let them, really. And this is partially because the international community was fearful of what would happen, and partially because of local resistance. Of course, that's part of it. It's very crucial where the school is located. Whoever knows Mostar, many people who know Mostar think that the east and the west side are divided up by the river. That's not true. It is actually this boulevard right here. You can't see it really well. This is what divides. So this is the Muslim side. This is the cross side. The cross side is all new and modern and socialist buildings. And this is the old neighborhood called popularly Mahalla. And the bridge is actually on the Muslim side. So that's why partially there is disconnect on the cross side from the bridge. And the school was located at the main boulevard, the real dividing line between two towns. So a symbolic, spatially very important place. This is what the boulevard looks like today. This is where the school is located. I'm taking a picture basically in front of the school. This is what students see when they come to school every day. This was the main, one of the main roads in Mostar before the war, where people would meet and chat, and this is what it is now, a ghostly strip of land. This is just some of the, I want to share some of the images. This is just across the street from the school. This is, you know, some of these really shocking images colliding of capitalist, neoliberal, commercial, next to totally destroyed Austro-Hungarian building. Like, Mostar is full of these paradoxes. This is the school, this, right there. So this is what students, this is my, on my path to school every day, this is what I saw. So you come to school loaded with these images. This is the front of the school. The school survived, even though it was, you know, at the boulevard, it survived, but it was really wounded. A lot of bullet holes in it. So what do I mean by this cartography of democratization, this peace building that's based on segregation? The school was divided through the process of total ethnicization. It is imagined as a space of an ethnic equilibrium. What I mean by this is ethnically symmetrical space. What you have, this is for those of you who can read, the first floor, and the first floor presented, you have one cross classroom, one Muslim classroom, one cross classroom, one Muslim classroom. Then you have the common area, which is the teacher's room, then you can again have one cross, one Muslim. The whole school is imagined in this kind of ethnically symmetrical place, which is overwhelming. You cannot escape it. You cannot be non-ethnic there. By just going to one classroom, you're defining oneself, right? Because it's marking you where you are. When you have students on duty, the jura, you have one Bosniak, one Muslim. You cannot have one of two of each of the same, right? So everything has to be perfectly balanced. Everything has to be all ads in two languages. Even though everyone can read either one, they have to be next to each other. Everything has to be perfectly ethnically balanced, even if that means waste of paper and typing time and whatnot. You have school books, dnevniki, which are in the red ones up there. You can see as well because of the light. These ones are red and they're for Croat students. These ones are black and they're for Muslim students, next to each other, equally distributed. Okay, so there are many places that the international community said, okay, it is ethnically balanced school. Let's create some spaces where students are together. So these formal spaces of reconciliation are based on this crudest calculation of ethnic minorities. For example, you have student council. The head of the student council is Croat. The vice president has to be a Muslim. Okay, so it, even if you bring them together, you keep the same kind of ethnic structure. Mixed debate club. You have to have five from one side, from the other. Even if seven Croats are better, they cannot be. There has to be five and five. And students say this. They say, well, wait a second, let's have the best ones represent us. They say, no, we have to make sure, because somebody out there will say, no, you're not fair. It has to be equal. So it penetrates into all spaces of international communities' reconciliation programs. Another one is empty computer lab. There is a big story about this computer lab. The fanciest computer lab in the region is in this school. It's a donation by the Japanese government. And the Japanese government, when the money for this was requested, they asked for this computer lab as a space where all students, regardless of their background, would be able to use the best technology. The Japanese government responded in spirit of this call and said, yes, here's the money, but it's only to be used for joint activities where students of both sides are there, whereas they have two different national curricula, meaning that there are never times when they're together. So for the whole first year I was there, this fancy computer lab was empty. So this is showing these kinds of tensions that I'm talking about on the larger level. During the hallways, during the recess in the hallways, students go outside of their classrooms and stand in front of their classrooms. So you have cross students right here and then Muslim students 10 meters down. So this is constantly, it's penetrating the movement throughout the space. And then on top of that, you don't have any images of ethnic affiliation or ethnic identity on the walls itself. The international community removed that, but they put their own images. So you have a lot of thank you plaquettes, whatever these are called, that show who donated money for what. So you have international community present everywhere, and they're in the hallways and everywhere, but you don't have many ethnic things on the walls. So what students do? Well, one day, one of the students said to me, well, Azra, do you want to come to No Man's Land? And I said, yeah, what is that? I want to. And I said, I have to grab my camera. So I went upstairs and I saw the vice principal, that's a Bosnia, because the principal is a Croat. So I said to him, do you want to go to No Man's Land? And he said, sure. So we followed this student, and he created between two classrooms, a Croat and a Muslim, No Man's Land space, where they come and stand in space that's not either Muslim or Croat. So the Bosniak vice principal, you know, seeing that I will take pictures, he steps into it and shakes the hands with a student. And this is a Bosniak and a Croat student sitting in, standing in this land. So students respond. Yeah, they're not passive recipients of this ethnicization of space. They respond, but these responses are, you know, they're limits of how far they go. Okay, I should go really fast through mixing them because I'm scared of how I'm doing. Okay, so in order for me to grasp what happens in places of no man's land, and I'll talk about Batum as an example of this, I use the a local term, miešanje, to grasp these instances of border crossing that are not seen by the international community or the local politicians or the teachers. I ask how these moments of border crossing fit in the process of democratization, okay? And what do they articulate about the nature of inter-ethnic interaction in post-war context? I will go through this really, really quickly. To miješati se, or mixing in Serbo-Croatian language means basically to mix oneself. And there is a history of mixing. When people say that's a mixed person, they usually think about a person coming from a mixed marriage of a Muslim or Croat or Serb, people who are children of mixed marriage. So that's what mixing used to mean in pre-war time. And there are many local usages of this. Mixed marriages, miješani brakovi. What I heard a lot in Mostar is that person likes to mix. Or this is a queen of mixing. There was one student who was labeled as such. And this term mixing has its own place. It's related to the notion of brotherhood and unity. It emerged in hand with that. And it was clearly represented in the phenomenon of mixed marriages. And I will not go through the history of this. There were many, many places in which mixing really took hold. Mostar was one of them, one of the most intermixed cities. And one of the, don't do this because I want to go through this really fast. One of the main arguments about what happened in Bosnia from an anthropological point of view was provided by Bob Hayden from Pittsburgh University, who said that basically wars in Yugoslavia were about forced unmixing of mixed people. But the nationalist politics, which is based on this notion of, you know, homogeneous ethnic populations, crashed with the reality on the ground. So you forced unmixing of mixed populations, okay? What I claim partially is that international community actually not only didn't do enough to reverse unmixing, but institutionalized unmixing, okay? Mixed marriages today, as a result of this politics of international community that actually institutionalized non-mixing, there are almost none in Mostar. Mostar had almost over 10% of mixed marriages before the war. There is less than 1% today. And one of my informants said, today in Mostar it's easier to be a bastard than to be a child from a mixed marriage. And imagine in my situation, I'm a mixed bastard, okay? So the worst it can happen to you in Mossad, he says. He was my favorite, one of my favorite informants. But it says, I mean, there, I have a whole chapter that talks about what happened to people from mixed marriages, and obviously I don't have time to talk about that. So what I'm saying is that mixing in the past, and at the beginning of my little ethnography, I mentioned that Amra said to me, let's go and mix. Well, she doesn't mean the same thing that mixing used to mean in pre-war Bosnia, where to mix meant to really be from a mixed marriage. And today, to mix means, this is, it means to approach a group of students from the other ethnic group. It means when someone spends time with the people of the other ethnic group. It's a rough expression, and we use it in our local Mostar jargon, says one student. Generally, that's hanging out, spending time with the students from other classrooms, meaning mixing shrank, okay? Today, to mix means much different thing than what it meant before. This generation doesn't think of mixed marriage when they say, let's go and mix. They mean, let's superficially, shallowly, just have a quick smoke. Okay, that's what it means. But it still means something. So what happens in the bathroom? I suggest that reading this extra academic architecture can tell us more than life in classrooms about nature and experiences of democratization. Extra academic sounds nicer, architecture sounds nicer than saying bathroom. Okay, so what happens there? Okay, the network of gazes, international, regional, family, school, all these things that overlook them, that constantly watch them, collapses in the bathroom. All that is gone. During my tenure at the school, not once did an adult enter, okay? Unsupervised students are abandoned to one another's gazes, okay? Bathroom emerged as a place of subversion, experimentation, and playfulness. In those 5 to 10 minutes, you can do a lot, I promise. Place for hanging out, sharing a cigarette, flooding the sink, the toilet bowls, discussing classroom work, fashion and dating, drawing hateful graffiti, that's also part of that. They experiment with ethnicity, through illicit smoking and prohibited flirting, and I'll show how. They develop short-term solidarity. Students are united against the school authority. This is contingent, fuzzy, and precarious feeling of interconnectedness. It's not necessarily lasting, but it's something. It's also a place of symbolic violence and tension, and I'll show now. So is Bacum possibly a place of post-identity politics? What happens? First of all, ethnically positioned bodies align themselves in a certain way in the bathroom. Usually you start by being next to somebody from the same ethnic group in the bathroom. And then they start challenging this boundary. Like one group stands on one side of the bathroom, the other on the other. And they start to talk, to realize we speak the same language, we understand each other. They start talking about religion, they're curious. They talk about money and corruption, about citizenship, about curriculum, smoking. So they're constantly assembling and challenging what's different and what's the same among them. So interconnectedness emerges as a smoking event. There is viscosity of ethnicity. At first, students stick to one another based on their ethnicity. But then counter-ethnic experimentations emerge from risky behavior, as I said, symbolic violence, flirting, linguistic appropriation, like when a dummy and a crowd boy says verses in Arabic. So they constantly flirt with these ethnic markers. So one example is when he recounts the verses from the Quran. Another one is the Croat student, self-proclaimed nationalist and Muslim hater, shares a cigarette with a Bosniak student who 1 year earlier stormed into a Croat school and insulted the students and teachers. A Bosniak girl who said she would never date a Croat gives a warm hug and a kiss to a Croat student and takes his cross and puts it around her neck as a joke. Okay? So this ethnicity is being queered, right? In this way, it challenges the pure forms of ethnicity by disconnecting or twisting ethnic markers from particular bodies. Even though if it's just temporarily, something does happen. They twist what it means to be a purely ethnic person. So this allows for temporary, uneven, and fragile connection among students to emerge. One of the students said, as a response to smoking, smoking doesn't kill it unites. It is also one of my favorite quotes. So these youth made play in ethnicity. Though fleeing and precarious, what they're doing in the bathroom subtly works away at the constricted and constricting notions of ethnicized segregation. These playfully executed resistant realities are not separable from the context of segregation and violence in which they have been generated. And into which they become enmeshed. I want to say that they, you know, they're working hand in hand with the oppressive structures of segregation. So there is a dialectic there. And there's a lot of violence that's projected into this space. There's a lot of mersh or piss off, or calling each other, you know, very hateful names, employed often in a playful way as well. I will not read this because I'm running out of time. So what do bathroom graffiti do? There's a lot of bathroom graffiti, and they're often hateful. Bali is a very derogatory name for Muslims, and there are such as graffiti as Bali, let God fuck you. There's another one that says Sefer Halilovic, which is the head who was a Bosnian army general who was then brought to The Hague and then freed. So this is obviously a Bosniak writing. They're claiming the space. There are a lot of signs, you know, such as neo-Nazi eagle atop swastika. A lot of nationalist symbols. I will not go into their meanings because, again, I don't have time. And they travel outside the bathroom as well. You see them on students' bags and all over. And this is right in front of the school. There is a graffiti that says, "There will be meat, there will be meat, we will slaughter the Croats." So, I mean, these moments of interaction also bring about space for tension and violence and hateful exchange. And then management of the school and the international community immediately try to remove them. Okay, so they don't want the school to be a site of this kind of violence. And I claim that an expression of a struggle over deterritorialization and reterritorialization and the constant negotiation of exclusion and exclusion is captured in these bathroom graffiti, because there is constant claiming and reclaiming of space. Graffiti are a type of encounter with the other that are not necessarily verbally mediated, as in the instance when a student was told "piss off," but expressed and confronted in visual signs. They mark the territory of the school as ours, while the school management is left to wipe out those messages, healing the scars in a way that allows for the hate to be erased and the future to be rewritten. So they're constantly reappearing and being reinserted. So as these examples have shown, the challenges to the ethnic order of democratization can coexist with the reinstatement of where one is coming from and who one is. As I said, these two processes are interconnected. I want to say that there is some of this ethnic playfulness that travels outside of the bathroom. There are two spaces in particular in Mostar. One of them is, somebody asked me once when I gave this talk, is there a bathroom on the state level? I mean, that's a great question, and there is no one. And that's partially the problem. There's no space that's in which people can interact in such a way, because it's so ethnically segregated. But there are a couple of public spaces that are emerging as an extension of the bathroom. One of them is the bar next to the school, the only bar in which groups, students from both sides go. Okay, it's called Kokoloko Bar. And there, they're not as free in terms of their interaction, but they're together in the same space, and that's something. And then there is the Brashevic Cultural Center, and that's the center that is the alternative youth. And there you can find youth from both sides. So there is some of it. And then there is Bruce Lee. There is a Mostar urban movement that claims to be, that's a group of youth that claims to bridge cultures in Mostar. And they couldn't come up with a symbol to represent them that would not be ethnically marked as Muslim or Croat. So they said, well, Bruce Lee. He also tried to bridge cultures. And we all watched him when we were little. So they actually made this statue in center of Mostar, in one of the parks. And the problem was, will the Bruce Lee face the Muslims or the Croats? Okay. That was the next issue. And then they decided it will face the north, so not east or west side, right? But then, of course, I mean, this is a gendered symbol too, for those of you who are like, I didn't care much about, what about Pipi Lugacharapa, right? But anyhow, then there are spaces outside of town. I will not go in depth. Workshops organized outside of Mostar. That's where students can intermingle and do. And I have much more on this, but I will not talk about that now because I don't have time. There is also coffee drinking. That's very rare. And it's a very important practice among youth in Bosnia and Herzegovina, coffee drinking. But there's no public space to enable for that, so I will not talk much about it. But it does happen, but it's still very, very limited. Another one is dating. Students say that dating would be that place where mixing would have to stop. Okay? Dating is the place where boundaries of mixing that's acceptable today is clearly defined. And when I asked students what does that mean, one of them said at this moment very few people think of mixing as a type, miashan is a type of dating. Most of those who would dare to do that would be killed by their parents. Unfortunately, that, meaning dating across ethnic divide, is not part of the mental makeup of most people here. We all lose so much with that separation, I mean with non-mixing. The other one of quotes is my favorite, and this is the last quote I'll read. You see, we look around, flirt, and romanticize about boyfriends. And what if you like someone from the other curriculum? If you just flirt with them a little bit for a few days, that's okay. You do not even have to mention it to your parents. But if it goes over a month, then it could become serious. Then you would want to get engaged because you cannot imagine living without them anymore. And then you would want to marry them. And you might do that if you love them very much, even if your parents do not approve. And then you would have to have kids with them. And that is when the troubles start. How will you name the child? Will you baptize or circumcise the child? When children grow bigger, they do not know which side to take, and they become atheists, and they start taking drugs. Okay, so this is exactly what it is. It's exactly this, from flirting in the bathroom, you can see the plot of possible life tragedy with kids taking drugs. And this is a very prominent view today. But I was totally speechless after this. So conclusion. So traditional mixing, and I didn't have much time to go in depth, but traditional mixing suggests culturally deeper, historically rooted, and regionally expansive feeling of otherness that cannot be acknowledged nor nurtured under the existing democratic regime of constitutional democracy that favors enclave multi-ethnicity. Mixing makes the existing Serb, Croat, Bosniak ethnic distinctions vague and therefore socially undesirable and politically untrustworthy. I mean, if you're mixed, you cannot almost politically exist or socially. Mixing in the bathroom is motivated by youth's resentment of local and international adult politics, their curiosity about the other, interest in flirtation, historically informed interconnectedness, and common experience of corruption and inequality. I didn't have time to go into corruption, but mixing is a part of, as a particular form of ethnic integration has been largely ignored by teachers, journalists, scholars, and politicians due to these, said above. As an analytic category, mixing captures those non-linear, in-between moments when tension, symbolic violence, structural violence, fear, and uncertainty are being confronted and contested through short dialogue, play, curiosity, interaction, communication, flirtation, possibility of friendship, and first seeds of trust. New forms of mixing thus simultaneously challenge and reinsert ethnic homogenization under the contours of democratization. These ethnic transformations, such as the ones in the bathroom, are often fleeting, even in the minds of the youth who created them. But that doesn't mean that they're not important. So, you know, we can conceive of mixing as a form of weak power, which recognizes the potential of bathroom smoking and superficial dating, but it also places this potential within the larger and oppressive structures of the state. While providing some room for hope, reworking of ethnicity and possibility for transcending nationhood in Bosnia, new forms of mixing are limited by the political logic of ethno-nationalism and the intrusive politics of internationally directed democratization. International democratization generates social and territorial arrangements that instead of inclusion lead to institutionalization of war-generated segregation among ethnic groups. Post-war Bosnian nation emerges as comprised of people who are defined as subjects with autonomous, intractable, observable, statistically represented and territorially rooted ethnic identities. As a result, democratization project in Bosnia-Herzegovina favors institutionalization of ethnicity over multicultural forms of peoplehood. New mixing among youth emerges as the secluded and subversive local practice which cannot be recognized by the existing framework of democratization. This is just kind of thrown from the rest of my dissertation, so it might be totally disconnected. And I misspell my name, so that you then don't be insulted if I ever email to you and misspell your names because I misspell my own. The particular model of international peace building in Bosnia leads paradoxically to the alienation of the majority of young Bosnians from the state in which they live. And I call this stance of anti-citizenship an empty nation, and I don't want to go into this, but the rest of my dissertation talks to that. The result is the production of denationalized and ethnically divided Bosnian youth. Instead of the nation-state, nationhood in Bosnia-Herzegovina today stems from ethnic ideology of identity, thus creating loyalties at the regional and transborder level among ethnic nations, Croats, Serbs, Bosniak, while leaving common Bosnian post-identity practices of weak power in no-man's land, politically and socially uncultivated. I'm so sorry I went so fast, I didn't realize how little time I'll have. So that's the end of it. And this is, I have to always put this at the end of my talk because I promised these boys that they would be part of whatever I do. So if I write a book, they have to be on the back cover. They said the back is fine. They don't have to be on the front cover. And this is one of my favorite, I mean, especially the guy who is talking on the cell phone. I mean, that. And this, these are mixing students. Okay, so I know I went really, really fast, but I hope you got a gist of it. And I'm open to whatever comments, questions, attacks you might have. Am I free to?
Please.
Alec, please.
Yeah, maybe you already mentioned this, but I was wondering, are you Bosniak or Croat or Serb, and how did that affect the research you were doing?
You see, this is like both very, very important and it drives me crazy, right, type of question. Because I'm so uncomfortable having to be put in one of those boxes that I so criticize, right? But once you're in the field, you cannot rise above the situation on the ground. I'm constantly saying, I don't care about the fact that I'm Bosnia, meaning Muslim. But it affected. It definitely affected the way I was, first of all, where I lived. Who I had access to, especially at first. But that's what anthropology is great about. It took me 6 months, really, to be invited to the first Croat home. But after that, those 6 months, I, you know, did start. My best friends in the field were Croats. Let me put it that way. But yes, there were moments when it was, you know, when I had to be very reflective, and when I felt like I didn't belong, when I felt that uncomfortable by probing certain things. And also, I felt very uncomfortable on the East Bosniak side because they claimed me, and I didn't want to be claimed. And they would tell me, you know, but you're one of us, you get it. And I was like, no, I don't. You know, or they would say, and then what I found was really useful is my 10 years in the States and my weak lungs, and the fact I married an American, and he, by accident, is Catholic. And that really helped with Croat. So, you know, you use your life, but at the end, as I said, you know, after a long time, I will never forget a moment. I was in a Croat classroom, observing the, you know, the German class taught by the only Bosniak teacher in the German curriculum. And the teacher had problems keeping discipline in classroom, and she said, come on, you know, stop behaving like this. What will this foreign woman say? And the guy stands up and says, Audra's not foreign, she's one of us. And I'll never forget, I mean, it took 6 months of being constantly with people. It takes, you know, there's a lot of mistrust there. But, you know, if you approach people in a humble way and, you know, in a way that shows that you really want to understand them, to the point I think I was so self-conscious about it that the first article I wrote, I received a review saying, you're taking a Croat side. I was like, what? But I think, As a researcher from there, you're constantly trying not to be positioned as subjective, especially if you come from the side that's supposedly the victim side. Right. So it was really hard, and at times, you know, frustrating. And but I think I got a slice of data and slice of picture that I couldn't have gotten if I were not local. But if you're local, you're labeled as one.
And maybe your research also contributed to the mixing phenomenon in some way.
Well, they smoked there while I was, before I came. But what did happen is that students would come to me and say, Azra, I know you sit in classrooms with them. Can you please introduce me to them? I cannot just go and say, I want to hang out with you because you're Croat. So I ended up actually matching people. I mean, saying, yeah, because I realized that I like mixing. So, you know, so it does. Yes, it did work that way. I did probably, as you inevitably do as a researcher, you impact the people you study. You change the environment. Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Alec. Yes.
What you say is very interesting. and at the same time very sad.
Yes.
And pathetic, really, because it comes after a fairly long period when these differences diminished somewhat, particularly in Bosnia, mm-hmm. among Muslims, mm-hmm. who consider themselves percentage-wise to be Yugoslavs, mm-hmm. rather than Bosnians.
Right.
Now, you talked about ethnicity constantly, back and forth, ethnic mixing and so on. Mm-hmm. Don't you think that it is more correct to say religious mixing?
Okay.
Because mm-hmm. if you take ethnicity in its old narrow, they are ethnically the same, language and so on. What separates them is religion. So at some point, it's not the acceptance of one's ethnicity, but of one's religion. And the war in 1992-95 was more a religious war than an ethnic war, although it was covered. So why don't we just look at the situation as it is, nakedly, rather than try to embellish it?
Okay, I think
under euphemisms, ethnicity.
I think you made a great point.
That may lead to a more correct and lasting solution if you tackle the basic cause, religious rejection. Let's put it this way. You can also say the same applies to Croatians and Serbians.
I'm not sure I understood the religious rejection the best. You mean rejection of Muslims? Is that what you mean by religious rejection? Rejection of what religion? Generally, I didn't understand only that part. But I think I'll answer the first part.
What I meant in the first part of my remarks is that the Yugoslav identity emerged as a supra-identity, which was the only way, in my estimation, that you create some sort of reconciliation among the sub-identities, be they Macedonian, Serbian, or Croatian. And in this case, I don't see that super identity.
No, you're right about a couple of things. There was something else besides you. On the level of Bosnia and Herzegovina, there was a notion of Bosnianhood. Let's put it as this, Bosanac, which basically was used as a term to capture all three groups. Okay, however you want to call them, religious groups, cultural groups. You know, you can create any name for them. And that is gone, or it's being overlooked by the process of democratization, this notion of Bosnianhood. Let's forget about Yugoslavia, but on the level of Bosnia, there were, and as you said, many, especially it has been recently pronounced, today mostly Bosniaks claim this notion of Bosnianhood that encompasses all three groups, however you want to define them. But they do give it a little bit of an Islamic slash Bosniak flavor, okay? So it's not like all of us, you know, it's all multiculturalism, we are all the same. It has, but Islam is what brings a special touch to Bosnianhood. So it's not, there's a hierarchy within that. But that's not politically explored, and that's partially what I'm saying. This level of the state-level identities is totally ignored by the politics. About ethnic versus religious, some people recommend that the best way to call this identity is ethno-religious identity, not only ethnic or not only religious, because both of them are exclusive and would leave out a lot of population. For example, how can you label them as religions when majority of people were secular? So it is true that when it comes down to what separates them, and they did and still, many would argue, speak the same language, cook the same foods, wear the same kinds of clothes. The only thing that it comes down to is this supposedly religious practice, but many people that supposedly belong to these groups don't even practice religion. So that's why I think calling it only ethnicity or only religion is misleading. I would have to do, if I would call it religion, I would have to do with religion the same thing you just did with ethnicity. Okay, say, well, it's not really religion because most people don't even practice, right? So I think, like Tone Bringa recommends ethno-religious identity to be, and I didn't want, I mean, to me, it doesn't really matter what you call it. You know, I'm just saying that the reason why I use it as a mnemic term in terms of anthropology, because that's the term that was imported by the international community. We never used etnička skupina or ethnic group in Yugoslavia prior to the war. It's an import. We talked about narod, right? Narod. We never talked about ethnic groups. So, you know, I didn't want to, I didn't try to define ethnicity here. I more used it as a unit of nation building project of the international community. So, and it's being invented. They're trying to engineer it. Because you cannot exist if you're not one of them. And you don't have to be a religious person.
So, well, I don't want to argue about this. It interests me greatly because mm-hmm. it's part of my field.
Right.
And I know the region very well. But I think you put your finger when you said ethno-religious identity. In my estimation, that is correct.
Okay.
Because in the Balkans, you cannot separate ethnicity
right.
from religion without being religious. You don't have to go to the mosque or to church, but still be a good Christian. You can't think of a Serbian without being Orthodox, or an Orthodox Serbian, which, you know, historically, they have merged into one identity. Very much as the Bošnjak, which is Serbian, I mean, Slav, and Muslim, has merged into creating a Bošnjak identity. Maybe the solution is to think in terms of finding a modus vivendi between these ethno-religious identities, Muslim, Catholic, and so on. I find it very difficult. I just read an article recently published about a textbook used in the Serbian schools. In the Serbian schools, the textbooks, Bosnian and Srpska Republika, they speak of Islam, of Turks, of the Ottomans as being the killers, murderers who've come there, destroyed all everything else. I mean, that continues the same well as it continued in older days. Whereas the Bošnjaks don't know what to say yet, the Muslims.
Well, I didn't want to go into the content of ethnic groups. That was not the point. I was more looking at how ethnicity was misused by the international community as the building block of the state. I didn't go into what constitutes it in all three groups, because that would be a totally different talk. But that was not the point. Okay, yes.
Okay, yeah, so let me ask precisely about that point. So I'm struck by how in your presentation you seem to suggest that the international community is to some degree responsible for this segregation, which, and there's some, all right, so fair enough to criticize the international community, I'm not going to sit here and defend them, but let me play devil's advocate. So,
yeah, please.
So first of all, there is somewhat of a tension in your argument when you suggest that this very mixing, which you see as is perhaps bearing more hope for a possible establishment of a common identity, that it assumes this spatial context of segregation, that you might not even have this mixing, at least it wouldn't take on the same meaning absent the context of segregation. So there is, if there are two sides of the same coin, the mixing and the segregation, then in what sort of universe or what sort of alternative policies of desegregation would you have more of an emphasis on mixing? Secondly, it does seem that within the school itself, there is some suggestion that it's not going to work to sort of create these spaces that are expressly devoted to mixing, and that's an example of this empty computer lab. If that room was created with the express directive that it be an open space for mixing and it's not used, that suggests that something other than this policy of spatial segregation might be at work here, and of course. And then finally, okay, so if I'm an international community person, and you know, a whole other question is, what is the international community? Is it really homogenous? You know, can I write a letter if I want to?
You can.
I can't. I'm good. I can't. It's probably the United Nations, UNDP or something.
OHR.
OHR, yeah. Of course. So if I'm thinking from their perspective, all right, maybe I'm thinking, well, okay, so I'm not going to really be able to have a fully integrated school in terms of the classroom and so forth. But isn't this a start? If you're thinking of a, you know, what you might call your geometry scale shift here, and what you're doing is sort of you're taking the segregation that happens on the level of neighborhoods and residential, and you're reducing the scale of that segregation to the classroom. And isn't that progress? Because precisely by establishing a school like this, where you forcibly bring together people of the different ethnic communities and put them in the same building, even if you're not forcing them to be in the same classroom, you're creating precisely the opportunity for this interstitial mixing type of activity, where actually you do have to decide a vote. Now, perhaps on the reality of the ground, where there's this tremendous animosity and tension among the communities, that is the most one could really hope for in practical terms for a policy that has at least some potential of working on down the line.
Oh, you said so many great things, and I think you should go and work for OHR. Because, but let's start with the last one, because that's exactly what they told me, because I worked as a consultant as well. But they would always come to me and say, how can we expand the bathroom? Mm-hmm. I mean, they still wanted, bring a bar to the school. But I think you're thinking about, in a way that you're envisioning this as a evolution, like a progressive thing, a linear progressive thing. I cannot, meaning maybe this is the first day, and then next day maybe time will pass and they will forget, or these generations will not remember as much, and maybe they will have a common classroom. Who knows? 20 years from now, that's how they think too. I don't want to lock myself to this kind of evolutionary notion, because I also think that much more realistic now is the fact that this school will be seen as just a very elite international community fed, full of money experiment that cannot work in other places, because look, they're still segregated. Okay, so I think it can be a circular thing, not a progressive thing. But yes, that's how political scientists and policymakers like to think, right? It's first step towards something else, but not if the rest of the country is totally segregated. You know, you cannot, how far does the school go? If you just have the school and then still the city is separated into two, I mean, they go to university on two different sides, right? So, I don't know, it's possible, yes, I don't know. I would have to go and do field work in 10 years and see what happens. So I cannot answer that, yes, maybe. I think, you know, and then the first thing, when you say, well, the way I talk about mixing, it does come from segregation. No, it comes from recognition of difference. And I think it's different to negotiate difference. And in order to do that, you have public space. Well, public space that doesn't belong to necessarily anyone, no man's land of a sort. So I'm not saying that actually this is a flip coin of segregation, but it's flip coin of living in a society that's full of difference of a sort. And you can negotiate that through very different models. It doesn't have to come from a constitutional model that segregates people. It can come through what people suggest is maybe a multicultural model of democracy that doesn't conceive of citizens necessarily as ethnically defined. I don't think you need segregation to talk. In the past, you didn't think about segregation during the Yugoslav times to talk about mixing. You thought more of communities being built of different segments, but not necessarily segregated, right? I mean, you think about difference and negotiation of difference. So I don't want to think that mixing is necessarily a flip side to segregation, but more to negotiating multi-ethnic societies. don't know if that satisfies that, but it does require some, you know, deeper thought. And then the other one was, okay, places of mixing. I think people were resisting more the fact that they were forced into ethnically calculated mixing spaces. Obviously, it works in places that are secluded. But if it works so you go there, but only five of you and five of you, there is resistance to that kind of idea. So I don't know if necessarily mixing in spaces the international community approved was not successful. Maybe the recipe for mixing is not successful. And that's what I'm saying. And why it's not successful? It's successful maybe in Northern Ireland, because maybe you have communities that have been historically segregated. Here you have a community that have, in anthropological terms, has an experience of exogamy, meaning of marrying out, and let's bring that out of one own group. Let's think about it more broadly. Community that conceived of itself historically in more flexible in that identity terms that often bridged over these differences and had a common identity. And I'm saying constitutional democracy nowhere provides space for that to be politically articulated. If you're of a mixed marriage, what did you do? This kind of segregation in Bosnia now left you with one choice: either be marginalized, say that you belong to one group only, or leave the country. Majority of them left the country because there is no space for them to express themselves politically, socially, culturally. No, like, who am I? Mixed bastard, right? I mean, that's what it comes. So I would not say that necessarily mixing is not. There's definitely local. I didn't talk, and you're right. You, in passing, you mentioned this too. I didn't talk about local ethno-nationalism. That actually, it's almost as if the international community built its project of democratization based on the politics of ethno-nationalism and not politics of dialogue. And that's, I think, my because they almost work hand in hand, right? There's still the people that they used to build this kind of segregated society. So, you know, I definitely, I don't know if I answered everything, but you did. I really appreciate these comments. I think that, you know, there's, but as I said, no, you're wrong. Yes, please.
I had a question about Albania, not Kosovo, but Albania itself. I mean,
throw that ball somewhere else, I think.
I mean, there you have Orthodox and you have Muslims. But as far as I know, there's relatively little tension between the two groups. Do you know what they've been able to do?
I really don't want to talk about Albania at all. I don't know who might answer that question to you. But
I just want to remark back to, you know, your model, because, you know, it's a very good example of, you know, kind of clashing ideas about what multiculturalism is. Mm-hmm. And obviously, international community, I hate that term, by the way.
Yeah.
It's oftentimes used as a sort of mask for American imperial penetration of certain regions. The so-called international community, you know, is obviously based on the kind of American idea of monocultural multiculturalism,
right.
In which obviously the burden of integration is placed on schools, like
right.
UC Madison,
right.
People like us, so they integrate, yet everybody stays in their own
right.
neighborhoods
mm-hmm.
and don't integrate, and so on. So, I mean, it's kind of a contradictory and paradoxical idea that is implemented in a location that has experienced some form of
right. multicultural.
Multicultural coexistence, I don't know
right.
how to call it,
right.
you know, for centuries.
Right. I also struggled with how to call it. That's why I call it mixing, but that's not good enough.
Right. No, but I'm just
yeah.
saying, because, you know, you can kind of see how the institutional framework that is put in place by the Dayton Agreement, which basically creates kind of the new Milat system, you know,
right,
returning
right.
to the
yeah.
Ottoman under the postmodern kind of conditions.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, they are all in their own little location. They can kind of coexist, but they cannot really mix.
Right.
So that is
right.
again, you know, supposedly they are building a multicultural society, but it's a huge
right.
kind of hypocrisy.
No, I agree. I think that's exactly what I was.
Politics,
yeah.
you know, because ultimately, if it goes on like this, the state will devolve. You know,
right.
If
no,
it
will
not integrate, the state
no,
will
the,
fall
the way
apart.
It's calling it, you know, it's empty.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's because, I mean, it's empty in the imagination of people.
Right.
Most of these youth don't envision Bosnia as their state because they feel so removed from it. But I agree with you. I think that it is the model, as I said, to, you know, I don't know how to capture this history of intermixing and coexistence in political science terms. So we can talk about multiculturalism without talking about multiculturalism that's so loaded here, right? I don't know what that is, but it's exactly the tension I'm trying to describe. And I agree, international community I used here, you know, in my work, I tried to be much more careful about what I
yeah.
mean by it. I didn't, I mean, that was not, in that it's so complex in itself and its own power games and its own power structures and who is who in that game. And I agree, it masks more than it says. But again, I don't think it's necessarily
like that. You know, that they want politically like to disunite Bosnia.
Oh,
I'm just saying that unconsciously they have another model to work with than the model that they bring out of liberal, you know, kind of understanding.
Just the opposite. They want to save Bosnia. No, so, I think many people honestly do believe that this is because it maybe worked somewhere else. But as I mean, if this model is going to travel, they talk about this as success still. Even you know, in Obama administration, Biden still says, "Well, I brought peace to Bosnia." And